Thank you, Ila, very much for the introduction and for the invitation to this wonderful event. Of course, I have the distinct pleasure or the distinct horror of speaking after Mladen Dolar, but I will try to break that with just showing you a clip from Lubitsch's movie, To Be or Not to Be. Some of you may have not yet seen it. Others may choose not to see tonight. So I will just give a little bit of context to the clip that I will show you. It's a clip that happens in the Gestapo headquarters, where the actor, the pompous actor Josef Thura, meets for the third time, I think, with the Nazi Colonel Erhard, the concentration camp Erhard. But he doesn't know that the Nazis have, in the meantime, already discovered that he's not the real Professor Siletsky, not the real Nazi informant. He's posing as this Nazi informant, but does not know that he has been basically found out, because the dead body of the real Professor Siletsky was already found out. And to make things even worse for Thura, his fake beard that he uses seems to be malfunctioning. So his fellow actors from the theater offer him another fake beard just in case something gets bad. So let's see now what happens at the Gestapo headquarters. There are so many comic principles at work in this sequence. Oh, by the way, I don't think I've mentioned this. The title of this talk is The Question of the Beard. And I think it's quite obvious why. So there are so many comic principles at work in this sequence. The most obvious one is perhaps the popular motif of doubles and mistaken identities, which is here wonderfully complicated. And Mladen elaborated on this question, working in comedy quite a lot. There is also a stark contrast between the deadly seriousness of the situation on the one hand and the gentlemanly behavior that Thura and Colonel Erhard never give up on the other hand. A contrast that is a very typical comic device. The writing, of course, is simply excellent, using clever repetitions rather than inventing new lines of dialogue. For instance, in their previous scene, Josef Thura suggested to the colonel Erhard that Captain Schulz was shifting responsibility back to him for a failure, of course, that Colonel Erhard himself did. And now Colonel actually repeats the same line directly to Schulz. And yes, as I think was quite obvious, even if you just watch this sequence, this angry cry Schulz becomes the running gag for the whole movie. An expression of Colonel Erhard's incompetence. And Robert Faller describes yet another principle at work in this sequence as the paradigm of success. Tragedies are based on the formula of failure, writes Faller, but comedies are based on success, even too much success. In the shown sequence, the fake beard is even an explicit topic of conversation. The Nazis ridicule the idea that the imposter could have worn a fake beard, and that instead he must have carefully observed Professor Siletsky for a long time before he was able to grow the exact same beard. And in the finale of the sequence, when Thura's colleagues from theater burst in the room masqueraded as Hitler's personal safety officers, the pompous actor that is posing as the commanding general shouts at the poor Colonel Erhard and delivers a stunning line. Here's a man with a beard and you didn't even pull it. I find that line to be extremely hilarious. As if upon seeing a beard, one should always assume that it is a fake one and have to pull it. But I want to draw your attention to another comic principle used masterfully here, which is the status game played between the protagonists, the Polish actor Josef Thura and the Gestapo Colonel Erhard. Thura starts here with a low status, as he has just entered into a trap. And the colonel is lavishly displaying his high status by playing with him as a cat would play with a mouse, showering him with excessive pleasantries and greetings. But when Thura begins to understand the situation and takes matters in his own hands, a radical change in status occurs. When the body is discovered to wear a fake beard, it is the colonel that must apologize, And Tura has the opportunity to be cocky and excessively benevolent, practically begging the colonel to pull off his beard. Now, status games are a popular mechanism of generating comic situations. The most obvious example for a status game, I think, is maybe from another World War II movie, another one that Mladen also mentioned, which is Chaplin's The Great Dictator, where the Nazi dictator Hinkel meets the fascist dictator Napoleone and tries to act superior by a set of rather silly games, like letting him wait outside a little bit in the office, or offering Napoleone a lower seat so that he would have to physically look up to Hinkel. That sequence from Chaplin's movie ends with a clown scene where both dictators are sitting on their barber chairs and keep raising them in order to speak to the other dictator from a higher position. The chairs are rising higher and higher, far beyond any reasonable height, almost to the roof. And then in the end, Hinkel's chair malfunctions and collapses to the ground position. So this is, I think, you know, a very explicit example of a status game. And it works very well in comedy. So in Chaplin's film, that status game, which starts within reasonable framework, then goes completely out of control into a clownish finale. But in To Be or Not To Be, the status game is played with elegance and finesse. Let me just note that Tura does not pull off the dead man's beard himself. You know, he goes at it, but then removes the hand. He rather starts with a clever scenario where he first observes, like, you know, he's playing the detective. He observes the dead body and admits that every little detail looks very bad for him, thus lowering his already low status and at the same time preparing the colonel to lose his calm and pull off the fake beard himself, precisely at the moment when the colonel should have triumphantly accused Tura as an imposter. But now I want to focus on what is of my main interest in this sequence, on the object that is at the center of this cleverly played status game, namely on the fake beard itself. On the one hand, the fake beard functions as a prop that enables the comic mechanism of mistaken identity, a comedy of errors. But on the other hand, there is more to it than just that. The beard embodies a mechanism of its own. It serves as an object that holds the power to either give utmost authority or to instantly take it away. Sorry. It is an authoritarian object, so to speak. It functions as the microphone functions for the speaker, as the scepter in King's hand. By the gesture of taking the microphone or by displaying the scepter for all to see, one immediately gets everyone's attention and is recognized as an authority that must be listened to. This is an aspect of the fake beard that cannot be reduced to the comic procedure of mistaken identity. A procedure that, by the way, is used in this comedy quite a lot. I'm claiming that there is something about this specific object, the fake beard, that captures the general atmosphere of the film. It is an authoritarian object for an authoritarian comedy. Generally speaking, in comedy, a wife may pose as her husband's lover and surprise him on their date. A man may dress as a woman to hide from mafia. And yes, a Pole may put on a fake beard and pose as a Nazi informant. But in this sequence, the imposture carries the specific meaning of an usurpation of authority. The status game that Tura and the colonel play hinges on the question of the beard. The claim of the comedy is, of course, that authority as such functions as an usurpation of authority. Authority is always staged and performed. If ever you should see a man with a beard, you should pull it. The fine point to be made here is that the fake beard is the object that makes the usurpation possible precisely insofar as it is a fake beard and not an authentic one. I would even go as far as to say that the authentic beard, the organic facial hair, can function as a symbol of masculinity and authority only on the condition that it is potentially fake. What I'm trying to suggest is that a fake beard is not just a later attempt to copy the authentic beard, but that it is, in a way, the other way around, so that the fake beard is somehow primordial to the authentic beard. I suggest that with beards, it is just like with Derrida's famous thesis about language. As you well know, of course, Derrida criticized the spontaneous assumption that writing is secondary to spoken word. We naturally assume that it is one thing to listen to someone speak in their immediate presence, when we can hear the voice, the inclinations, the passions, where there is always the possibility of an interruption. But it is quite another thing to read the text of their talk. Writing appears as secondary to spoken word, not only in temporal sense, but specifically on the level of the concept, because writing necessarily involves a delay, a mediation. Derrida criticized this assumption as the assumption of the metaphysics of the presence and claimed that the necessary delay or mediation, typical for writing, is in fact precisely what constitutes language as such, including the spoken language. In this sense, writing is primordial to the spoken word. And in this precise sense, I am suggesting the idea of the primacy of the fake beard over the authentic one. It is the fakeness of the beard that makes the beard an authoritarian object. The fakeness is its precondition. This is why I say that the organic beard can function as an authoritarian object, that is, as an object that holds authority, only if it is in itself something that could be fake. Now, we can call this fake beard a negative object. It is negative in the sense that it is not so important for its physical, affirmative characteristics, but rather because it can be easily detached and reattached, and because it doesn't belong to any specific chin. It is a fake beard, but it could also be a fake mustache, fake glasses, fake hat, and so on. This negative character of the object of the fake beard I find philosophically most interesting. And with this, I would like to proceed to the second part of my presentation today. I will use this microscopic reference to Lubitsch's work and discuss it in the frame of a much larger question. I will try to sketch in broad terms how I think this negative object of the fake beard fits in the general debate on negativity. The explicit question of negativity, well, is gaining more and more interest in current philosophical studies and debates, and it could be said that a vast continent of contemporary philosophy depends on the question of negativity. And I claim that there is a correspondence between the many philosophical concepts of negativity on the one hand, and the negativity that can be described as a mechanism of production of comic effects on the other hand. I will therefore digress from Lubitsch, but not from comedy and not from negativity. Generally speaking, I think we could say that comedy is a practice of the negative. Something crooked, something falling, something suddenly exploding or bouncing. These things have always been exploited in comedies to produce laughter. The privileged example of someone suddenly stumbling in their walk can be found in renowned considerations of comical, like for instance in Bergson's famous essay. As well as in contemporary practices, Jos Hoban from the Lecoq School in Paris, for instance, gives special attention to this very simple minimalist example of someone stumbling in their walk in his brilliant performance The Art of Laughter, which was performed in Ljubljana in the context of Young Lions festivals in 2010, I think. Now, historically, comedy is considered a low genre, something that Ivana has pointed out in Mladen as well, especially with regard to tragedy. Based on Aristotle's arguments in Poetics, an entire hierarchy of forms was developed, where tragedy is the most accomplished one and comedy is dragging at the bottom. This hierarchy seeks confirmation in the choice of artistic material used and transformed by the genres in question. So Aristotle famously writes, I'm quoting, "Comedy aims at representing man as worse, tragedy as better than in actual life," end of quotation. So tragedy is somehow intimately connected to sacred rituals and religion, while comedy, with its power of laughter, apparently forms an opposition to and mockery of these normative practices. Comedy works with foolish mistakes rather than fated ones. While tragic personae like Antigone carry on their shoulders some great burden of humanity, comic characters are more often than not involved in matters of no actual importance. The traditional perspective on comedy seems to suggest a parallel between ontological hierarchy on the one hand and a hierarchy of genres on the other hand. In this context, comedy is a practice of the negative in the sense that it produces and works with lower or degraded or deformed material. Of course, this perspective raises important questions. For instance, the question of comedy as a practice, as a possible practice of subversive negativity. But this is not of my primary interest here. There are, in fact, many different concepts of negativity discussed and developed, where different authors use different concepts, and sometimes they equivocally use more than just one. This is why I think we should distinguish between some of the most fundamental conceptions of negativity in contemporary philosophy. So what I will do is simply propose very cautiously and on the background of, you know, of the historical perspective on comedy as a practice of the negative, a typology of negativity. So I want to formulate in broad sketches a typology of negativity that underlies much of the contemporary debate, that between Lacan and Deleuze, Althusser and Hegel, and at the same time offers a pathway to understanding at least a part of the mechanism of comic production. Now, the typology I propose focuses on three instances of the negative. I call them torsion, lacuna, and contraction. There are three ways in which nothingness can be said to nevertheless determine being in some way. What they have in common, torsion, lacuna, and contraction, is that they are strictly to be understood as determinations of being, as transformations that operate on the level of being itself. The term torsion here refers to any idea of an ontological curve or fold, of twisting or bending, of Möbius strip or other such concepts. Lacuna refers to concepts of lack and surplus, gap, rupture, hiatus, absolute end, a radical break or cut, ontological explosion, but also death, finality, and so on. And finally, contraction denotes something that is ontologically unfinished or unrealized, something not yet fully there, but at the same time something that functions precisely as if this unfinished state were its only possible state with its necessary effects. Now, to present concrete cases of torsion, lacuna, and contraction as conflicting understandings of negativity, I chose the concept of clinamen as exploited in Althusser's theory of the materialism of the encounter, the Hegelian-Lacanian concept of subjectivity as negativity, and Deleuze's concept of the virtual, which is maybe a bit controversial. Now, for Althusser, I will walk really very quickly through these examples. For Althusser, ideology has a material existence insofar as every action of a subject is always already inscribed in a material practice governed by a material ideological apparatus. There is no subject save from a subject of an ideology. Althusser's critics argue that what he proposes is basically a functionalist theory, a theory that reduces all relations to relations of domination, where there is no practice of emancipation that is not already a practice of domination. His Lacanian critics, Dollard and Žižek, raise a similar objection and claim that his theory can only account for a successful interpolation. If a subject is always already an ideological subject, it is impossible, they claim, within Althusserian framework, to think beyond ideological interpolation. Now, in this criticism of Althusser, we can hear the echo of the criticism that Hegel addressed to Spinoza. So, just as Spinoza is under criticism that what he proposes is a blind determinism, a substance that cannot think free subjectivity, so Althusser is under criticism that he proposes a mere functionalism. Hence, I think the challenge that Althusser addressed in his later thought is precisely this: how to think surprise or chance, but to stay within the Spinozist framework of relations of power. And Althusser's answer came in the reference to the Epicurean concept of clinamen. And he describes it something like this: atoms are falling down parallel to each other, but then one of them swerves in an act of pure chance, and so it collides with another atom, and the world is formed. Althusser's materialism of the encounter, or as he also calls it, aleatory materialism, is a way to think such an original swerve, the original decline of being, or rather, an original decline within being itself. For this clinamen, this chance decline, this swerve, is precisely what constitutes being in the first place. It is important to note here that torsion does not come over being that was initially erect, undistorted or not contorted, but that the torsion is constitutive of the being itself. Now, as far as the example of lacuna is concerned, we can extract it from the very Lacanian criticism of Althusser's theory of ideology. As Dolar and Žižek proposed, the Lacanian subject is precisely the impossibility of becoming the Althusserian subject, the successfully hailed ideological subject. They point out that as the Althusserian subject emerges along with its symbolic order, there also emerges a necessary remainder that cannot be successfully and fully integrated, a remainder that is foreign to the very order it nevertheless pertains to. To understand this correctly, we must think of this remainder as something that is produced by this initiation, just as it is at the same time its necessary condition. So on the one hand, the remainder is a surplus, but it is an addition that haunts the whole it is added to. This is why the remainder is not only a surplus, but just as well a lack, some crack that tears apart the structure of the symbolic order. It is no wonder, then, that Lacanians often describe their idea of the subject as lack, hiatus, gap, or also as lacuna. So the term lacuna denotes negativity in the sense of this duality of surplus and lack, this protruding gap, as we may call it, in the structure of the symbolic order. And now finally, let me briefly, I know this may be a little bit weird because I'm going through, you know, all these big theories and concepts very quickly. But, you know, just allow me to walk through this and then get to where I see how comedy plays with these concepts of negativity. So let me give an example of what I mean by negativity as contraction. And this is obviously the most controversial point because I will refer to Gilles Deleuze, who made it very clear, of course, that he rejected the philosophy of negativity in favor of philosophy of affirmation and non-Hegelian difference. Nevertheless, some of his concepts can be considered as concepts of negativity at least from the perspective of the traditional metaphysics. His concept of virtuality, for instance, is a very productive transformation of Aristotle's pair of actuality and potentiality. Aristotle's theory of actual and potential is very complex, of course, and takes on its subject matter from many perspectives. But for the purposes of this presentation, I will just radically reduce this complexity to a very simple distinction, where actuality refers to things which exist, potentiality to things that only have a potential to exist. So before we can say that the latter really are, they have to be first actualized. Now, Deleuze pointed out that there is also a certain actuality of the potentiality itself. There are objects that do not have to get actualized before they can have actual effects. And when we consider such actual effects of something that exists only as a potentiality, which means that it has no actualized manifestation, then that something is called virtual. Deleuze develops this concept in his discussion on psychoanalytic concept of partial objects. Specifically, he refers to Lacan's seminar on Edgar Allan Poe's detective story, The Purloined Letter, where a clever thief hides a stolen letter in plain sight. So an object being masked by its obviousness, an object missing in its very place, is precisely the idea of the virtual object. Now again, Deleuze himself would certainly not speak of this concept of the virtual as negativity. But while he proposed this concept precisely to counter Aristotelian distinction between actual and potential, between perfect being and not yet perfect being, precisely to counter Aristotle's idea that being is equivocal, Aristotle has this in, I think, his seventh book of metaphysics. He starts by saying precisely this, that there are many ways in which we may say that something is, whereas Deleuze, of course, insists on univocity of being. So, but we can still consider this as a form of negativity, if by negativity we don't mean a degradation of being, but rather a transformation of it. In fact, all three proposed concepts, torsion, lacuna, and contraction, discard the metaphysics of the hierarchical being, of the hierarchy of genres, and so on. To give three very naive but explicit images, an object can be bent or twisted, it can be cut or broken, or it can be mashed like potatoes to make some plasticine-like substance. Now, through the eyes of traditional metaphysics, all these negativities are negative in the sense that they are secondary, since being was initially perfect and negativity only came afterwards, but also in the sense that they are a deformation or degradation of being. But I think we can say that modern philosophy as a whole rests on the idea that being itself is only constituted through and by such negativity. So where metaphysics sees a unity between the beard and authority, contemporary philosophy in general insists on the primacy of negativity, on the primacy of the fakeness of the beard. The three conceptions of negativity are basically three ways to think the capacity of being to transform itself. Now let me finally address the question of how exactly does comedy come to play with these three philosophical concepts of negativity. So firstly, there is what we could call the comedy of torsion. Now, comedy offers countless examples of perversions, distortions, ironies, mirror acts, slips of the body and of the tongue, but above all, mistaken identities and mistaken sexual identities. The example from classic film comedy is Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot, especially Jack Lemmon's performance of Jerry or Daphne. The plot is very simple. Two musicians on the run from mafia dressing girls to join an all-girl band. But Jerry's disguise gradually takes over and even wins a marriage proposal from a millionaire. And when in the end, Jerry, dressed as Daphne, finally takes off his costume and admits that he's a man, the millionaire only shrugs and delivers the final punchline: nobody is perfect. Now, this is a comedy of fortunate and less fortunate twists in the sexual position, but also in the plot. The sexuality itself is completely fluid. The object of sexual attraction keeps transforming into the subject of sexual identity and back. Remember how Joe tells Jerry to keep telling himself that he is a woman so that he would not court Sugar? They're still on the train, right? This is an episode. They're still on the train, and of course both are extremely attracted to Sugar, played by Marilyn Monroe, but they're both of course dressed as women. And Joe then tells Jerry, you know, remember, you are a woman. And then later, of course, Jerry must tell himself that he is a man, because he gets overexcited about the marriage proposal from the millionaire. So, but why is this specifically an example of torsion in comedy and not of lacuna? The key element, for me at least, is the fact that the transformation from one state to the other is gradual and continuous. It is almost impossible to say when exactly does Jerry not only wear the costume of Daphne, but becomes Daphne. When he is a man who must pretend that he is a woman, and when he becomes a woman who must remember that she is actually a man. There seems to be a Mobius strip of identity and sexuality where the twists occur by walking in a straight line. So this strip, I think, is the home of the comedy of torsion. So then what is specific to the comedy of lacuna? All sorts of sudden explosions come into consideration here, abrupt changes, as well as lacks and surpluses, but especially detachable phallic items, like for instance the fake beard from Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be. What does it mean to say that the fake beard is a phallic object? Just the basic secret of the Lacanian concept of phallus is, you know, because I don't know any deeper secrets of it, I will have to admit. But the basic secret is that it doesn't designate an organ. In fact, the true designation of phallus is castration. The fake beard is therefore not phallic because it is a beard, something that is typical for the male sex and limited to it. No, the fake beard is phallic because it is fake, because it is in its essence something detachable. And comedy of lacuna functions precisely by exploiting objects' detachability. And I think now it's more obvious why it is so important for me to insist that the sequence from To Be or Not to Be we saw earlier, the sequence between Josef Thura and Colonel Erhard, is not exhaustively explained with a reference to the comic mechanism of fluid identity. Because the mechanism of the fluid identity and sexuality is basically the core province of the comedy of torsion. But the comic effects in the sequence are only in part connected to questions of identity. The mechanics that is predominantly at stake is something I described as a status game or as an authoritarian object, as something that is essentially usurped, and what we could also perhaps call the phallic mechanism. But how do we distinguish the comedy of lacuna from the comedy of contraction? Isn't the phallus precisely the virtual object par excellence, and should therefore fall into the proposed category of contraction. Now, the key element of comedy of lacuna is the oscillation between the lack and the surplus. One moment it is there, the next moment it is already gone, it has never been there in the first place. The comic pleasure arises through and by such abrupt alternative of presence and absence, of attachment and detachment. This is not the case in the comedy of contraction. The virtual does not alternate between actual and potential, rather it is suspended in their in-between. Where can we find the comedy of contraction then? Let me make an initial assumption and claim that the comedy of contraction is the comedy of the body. There is a large tradition of the organic, biological humor of bodily functions and fluids. Especially the tradition of carnival explores a plethora of comic actions that the human body can perform in endless repetitive processes, like gorging, vomiting, contracting, squirting, drinking, and most importantly, farting. On the one hand, it seems that these processes are only comic because of their relation to the assumed dignity of the comic character or of his office. A king that vomits, a bishop that drinks, a beauty that farts. This kind of comedy can be seen as somewhat problematic, as it does not really put the office of the king, the bishop, or that of Miss World in question. When Mikhail Bakhtin famously described a wide range of folk rites and festivals in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance as part of his study on carnivalesque traditions in the works of François Rabelais, he pointed out that there was a certain complicity between the sublime earnestness of official church festivals and the obscene playfulness of the folk festivals. He went as far as to claim that the folk festivals could only have risen to weigh so much influence in the society because the church has so thoroughly imprinted in it the idea of the importance of being earnest. The obscene comic of folk festivals is perhaps nothing more than a very controlled and clearly defined outburst of frustrations over the ruled classes and slaves over their rulers and masters. The obscenity of carnival is allowed, but also necessary, but also made necessary in the first place by the seriousness of the formal official culture. Now, this argument is certainly an important point that many scholars have raised, and yet it leaves the question whether the body is comical in itself unanswered. In order to claim that the apparent materialism of the carnival is naive, one has to suppose the culture dominated by an austere idealism. But what can we say about the body which does not need an ideal soul in order to be considered material? And this is what is actually at stake in the modern affirmationist philosophy, for instance in the works of Deleuze, Negri, and other neo-Spinozists. So to think precisely the body that does not need an austere soul. And I guess we could say that the ontology of the French materialism of the 20th century is materialist in this precise sense. It relies on ontological virtuality, on some sort of elasticity or plasticity or expansion of being. The material texture of reality can be contracted or expanded. It is such elasticity of being that I propose to call contraction. Hence the question is, can we consider the exaggerated contractions of the body as comic, even without the immediate cultural context of an austere idealism, which in fact allows, requires, and produces them? The answer is yes, we can. Of course. The classic example of the comedy of the body is Rabelais' Gargantua. But the reason is not in its carnivalesque and folk elements, which obviously, of course, depend on the culture of an austere religion, but rather in the elasticity of Rabelais' language and style, whether they are carnivalesque or not. It is the language that stretches and bounces from the most obscene genres to the most sublime ones, that compiles endless lists of ad-lib toilet accessories, insults, names, and so on, that is joyfully playing all the time with its capacity to repeatedly produce new series of elements simply by devouring and reincorporating old ones. So perhaps a better example, or at the very least not a misleading one, of what is at stake here is the work of Raymond Queneau, especially his Exercise in Style and Blue Flowers, which were of course massively inspired by Rabelais, creating neologisms in explicit and in, implicit quotes of the old master, in metonymic and non-committal, even grotesque storytelling, and so on. This example is better since here it is quite clear that comic effects produced in these works are not related in any way to carnivalesque motifs, to the motifs of the exaggerated body and bodily functions. So the initial assumption of comedy of contraction as the comedy of the body should be revised then. It is primarily a comedy of language, of the capacity of language to reproduce itself through itself. And as the exercises in style demonstrate, this capacity of language can also be called simply style. Why not? Style is in fact an essential capacity of language. Style is precisely the excess of form in language. It is what is virtual in language. It is its unactualizable potentiality. Every text has a style. Even neutral account of facts is a specific style of telling a story. And yet every particular word is just a word among other words. You can never find style, you know, in one hiding in one word, an added word. In a sense, style is therefore what is hiding in plain sight. It is missing in its own place. It is rhetoric eloquence that makes language not only a means of communication, but also a means of production. This productive capacity of language, this excess of language over the language itself, is what I primarily call contraction. Now, looking back on Gargantua, we can say that the giant's excessive corporeality is not comic, again, because of the carnivalesque motifs, at least not in the sense I wish to attribute to the concept of comic contraction, but rather because this excess of corporeality demonstrates the excess of language itself. The perspective of contraction is not that the language describes some fascinating contractions of the body, but the other way around. It is the body itself that speaks out the contractions of language. So this is then what I think are the three concepts of negativity, which are at work in a significant part of contemporary philosophical debates, and we can at the same time see them also as mechanisms of comic production. At this point, of course, their exact relationship remains unclear to me, but hopefully these considerations can provide a basis for a more thorough analysis. Thank you very much.